It's Ouch, the show that likes to confront the awkwardness around disability. I'm Rob.
And I'm Kate. On this edition, we'll be moving from what's been dubbed inspirational porn through to teenage YouTube stars and matters of life and death with our guests Stella Young, Jack Binstead and Tim Wotton.
Later, our Cures correspondent will be here to talk about how we should be careful if we see a scientific breakthrough reported, and then it's our monthly quiz.
And to end, we've got music from Sisters of Invention, a learning disabled Aussie girl band who do a good number in 80s retro pop.
Don't even vaguely consider going anywhere.
Ouch, Disability Talk from the BBC with Rob Crossan and Kate Monaghan.
Welcome to show number 113 with Disability Talk, whatever that is, for the next 55 minutes.
55 minutes.
I know, forever. So lucky.
Right, let's say a brief hello to our guests so you can hear their voices. Stella Young is a comedian and was the editor of an Australian disability website called Ramp Up, which closed earlier in the year. And Stella, why did it close? Because we liked it.
Thanks, I liked it too. It basically closed because it was funded by the federal government and they pulled the funding for it.
Boo.
Boo, indeed.
So across to Jack Binstead now. Jack is 18 and starred as one of Jack Whitehall's pupils in the BBC Three comedy Bad Education, which, Jack, was brilliant, wasn't it? It was a great show.
It was absolutely amazing. I had such a great experience filming that over the last few years.
Yeah, it was one of my favourite comedies of the last couple of years. But more on him later. But Jack, tell us, you gave up the idea of being a wheelchair athlete to be on the telly. I thought, doesn't everyone want to be a Paralympian these days? You get loads of sponsorship, you know?
I was training nearly every night for 3 hours a night in the pouring down rain, and I wasn't able to go to, like, you know, my friends' birthday parties and hang out on weekends. You know, I couldn't do all of that, so I kind of just wanted to take a break.
And we will explore that further a little bit later in the show. And with similar athlete-like alacrity, let me move on to Tim Wotton. He has cystic fibrosis, which, if you don't know, is a life-shortening condition which affects the lungs. At his birth, doctors didn't expect him to live into his teens. But he's now 43, and he's got a book out called How Have I Cheated Death? So, Tim, when people find out that you've got CF, what do they generally say? What are the initial comments?
Well, we do battle with the fact that it's not that well understood. Mm. So most people give me that sort of vague look that they've sort of semi-heard of it. So I have to break it down in very simple terms. I do have type 1 diabetes as a neat side effect of my CF. But I joke that it's at least I've got an illness someone's heard of.
Nice. Well, let's turn first to Stella. So earlier in the year, Stella Young got the world thinking and laughing when her TED Talk was released. In short, it was about how she was tired of being thought of as an inspiration. We'll talk about the reaction you got in a minute. But first, can you tell us a bit about this thing that you called inspiration porn?
Yeah. So I had noticed over a long period of time that people were sharing on Facebook and Twitter and, you know, whatever forms of social media, you know, we could get our hands on, there was a tendency to share things that make people feel good, you know, whether it's cat videos or pictures of cute puppies. But the predominant thing that I noticed was that people would share pictures of disabled people, primarily children, with, you know, inspiring sort of quotes like the only disability in life is a bad attitude. One of my favorite ones was actually the little girl with no hands who was drawing a picture with the pencil held in her mouth, and the caption for that one I think was, "Your excuse is invalid." And of course, invalid is also the same word as invalid, which is quite, I thought was quite amusing just from a language perspective. But what I really noticed was that people would share these images and say, I was having a really bad day, but now I feel so much better because my life could be worse. I could be that person. And my question was, well, what if you are that person? What does it feel like to be objectified as an object of inspiration? Because we all want to make disability seem like it's just one simple thing. And what I keep saying every chance I get is that disabled people are complex. We are not one thing. Disability doesn't just mean one thing. in society. It's a whole range of things. And disabled people, great, and some are awful, and, you know, we're flawed individuals in the same way that everyone is a flawed individual. And it's really unfair to objectify us and to hold us to some kind of standard
so that Stella can be motivated. Isn't using the word porn, isn't that quite provocative? Yeah. And does that work?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does. I use the word porn quite deliberately because the inspiration porn, you know, it's objectifying one group of people for the benefit of another group. So in this case, it's objectification of disabled people for the emotional benefit of non-disabled people. So I think that the word porn, it is provocative, but I couldn't, you know, I can't think of a better way to describe it, really.
And what was the reaction like to your TED talk? I mean, I'd encourage everybody to go and watch your TED talk because it is just a masterpiece of public speaking, whether you agree with it or not. But what kind of reaction have you had since?
Look, I've had all the usual kind of reaction, you know, a lot of YouTube trollers and all of that stuff. And I've had lots of disabled people say, thank you so much. I have been trying to put my finger on that feeling for a long time, and you've articulated really well what I have felt for my whole life. But there were other people saying, you know, of course I'm an inspiration because I'm disabled. Look at all this stuff I have to deal with. And I think it is inspirational that I get out of bed and remember my own name in the morning. And look, both of those views are equally fine. And what I always seek to do with the things that I put out into the world is just make people think about it a little bit more. Like, if you think about it and you still hold that view that you as a disabled person want to inspire non-disabled people by going, I've got it worse than you, then go ahead. Who am I to object to that? But I do think that we just need to get our heads around the fact that disability is complex.
Your determination to be seen as not an inspiration seems to have ironically made you quite inspiring.
To Rob, anyway, that's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, that was actually one of my points, was like, I'm very happy to inspire people with my work and the things that I say, but I'm not happy to be congratulated on the train in the morning just for being on the train as a disabled person. That's
Jack, are you
appropriate.
Are you an inspiration?
I'd like to think that I come across as one, but then I see where Stella's coming from with, you know, the whole being congratulated for being on the train thing in the morning, because, you know, it's not an inspiration that we're on the train in the morning. We're like everybody else. We got up, we do our lives, and we get on with it. But when I sort of think of, you know, what is an inspiration, you know, I think that an inspirational person is somebody who overcomes, you know, a limitation that they've got, or they overcome a circumstance or something that's like a big barrier in their way, whether it's physical or mental, it doesn't matter. And they overcome that and they achieve what they set out to achieve. You know, I class that as inspirational. And, you know, people need to remember that not just people with disabilities are the inspirational ones here. Able-bodied people are inspirational as well, just as much as we can be. And people need to remember that, really, you know, it's not just sort of subjectifying that down to disability.
Tim, being an inspiration is something quite different in your world. I mean, for somebody who wasn't supposed to live past their teens and is now 43, do you see yourself as an inspiration for other people with CF?
That's a really good question. By the fact I'm still alive and doing well at 43, I'd offer hope. I don't know if inspiration. I probably inspire people who have good health more than I do people who have poor health. Mine's a sort of locked away type illness. It's not terribly visible. People don't see what I go through every day, 3 hours, to stay relatively well. They don't see the coughing fit in the middle of the night. So it's not so visible. The cough that they'll hear could just be a normal cough or cold. So there's less signs for people. So it's not as readily obvious as maybe Stella and Jack. But the fact I've written about it allows people to actually understand what I go through and almost lift the veil on what it's taken to survive such a severe illness.
I know, Tim, obviously you're a parent yourself. I think I want to hear what Stella's got to say about this, because I know you have a lot of criticism for the parents of disabled people, don't you?
Yeah, I do. And I think it's because I fail to be what people expect of a disabled woman.
What do they expect?
And a disabled person. I think they expect us to be very grateful, very, you know, falling all over ourselves to make non-disabled people feel comfortable in their prejudice, and to make sure that, you know, we're not putting anyone out, and we're certainly not challenging anyone's thinking. So when someone will say to me, you know, you're such an inspiration, I'm like, can you tell me more about that? Why do you think that? My own parents had a very interesting experience when I was about 15. And I grew up in a really small country town and had a very normal kind of upbringing. And a woman, when I was 15, approached my parents and said, oh, I really want to nominate Stella for a community achievement award. And my parents said, well, you know, that's really lovely, but actually she hasn't achieved anything. Like, she actually hasn't done anything. Like, she's a stroppy teenager who, you know, is not meeting curfew. You know, she gets good grades and she's all right. But, you know, I wasn't any kind of outstanding kid. Like, I wasn't...
You weren't a role model. You didn't want to be a role model, clearly.
No, and I wasn't doing anything that my non-disabled peers weren't doing. Mm. And that's the thing that my parents tried very hard to stress to this woman, is that what she was actually saying to them was that I was more than what she expected a disabled person to be, because I was being a successful, functioning teenage girl. And we have a bar that we set for disabled people that is so low that just living quite ordinary lives is seen as an inspiration or an achievement. Mm-hmm. And that's actually not a compliment. It's not saying that, you know, you're doing more than I expect of you, because what I expect is actually very little.
I see that on Facebook a lot when I see friends' children being nominated for Children of Courage Awards because they've got a disability. And I just think, you haven't done it.
I won that.
Did you do anything?
No.
To win it? No.
Yeah, what courage did you display to be a child of
exactly.
courage?
This is the thing, and I was put up for a Children of Courage Award when I was about 6. And I got down to, like, the top 30, and that was it. And it was purely because someone nominated me for the award. And I guess, you know, they considered the courage coming from breaking all these bones but still sitting there smiling. And so that's where they saw the courage come from. But then, I was up against people who they were in a different league of courage to where I was at, because this was just my everyday life. You know, I was born with this condition, I'll have this condition forever, so this is not courage, this is just me doing me. Whereas I was I was in the award against, you know, people who had saved their parents in house fires and had lost limbs, and that was a completely different boat, right? That's a different level right there, and they deserve to be up there for that award, whereas I didn't. But there was no way that I could, you know, people saw courage and went for it. And so,
and ultimately, you know, how harmful really is it? When, I mean, you know, I can see why it might be considered patronising. We've all talked about this, about, you know, doing something quite menial, like taking a train or eating a flapjack unassisted, you know, or using a calculator. But if an able-bodied person looks at you, you know, on the train or eating your flapjack and thinks that's brilliant, I mean, is that really doing any harm, Stella?
Yes, it's really annoying. And it is absolutely doing harm. It does harm to me as an individual, because I'm constantly being reminded that nobody really expects anything of me. And that expectation translates to other things. Mm. You know, we have incredibly low rates of employment of people with disabilities in Australia. We have very, very a poor education system for students with disabilities who are not able to be in mainstream schools because of a lack of support. Like, what these things all feed into one another. And if you have low expectations of a disabled person, you're not going to hire one to work for your company, are you? If you think that a person's capability begins and ends with the fact that they can just function in society, then you're not actually going to look for what they can bring to the table, because you underestimate what they can offer. And I guess that it does do harm.
Yeah, and I guess that if you're giving a child an award for being courageous just for you know, not actually doing anything, continuing to breathe, then you're almost giving that, you're bringing that child up in a sense of entitlement that just because they're, you know, getting on a train, that they deserve recognition, they're special, they're different, when actually what you want to do is bring a child up to say, you have to work hard just like everybody else.
I think that teaching disabled children in particular that we're inspirational for not doing very much does us all a disservice because, you know, that attitude of entitlement is something that I do see in some other disabled people, and it's a really rude shock to them when they face discrimination and things like that, because they do feel quite entitled to the accolades that they receive for not doing very much. And my parents always, they knew other parents of disabled children who would constantly say, well, you're special, you know, things are different for you, you're brave and courageous and all of those things. And my parents said, you are just like everyone else. You deserve the same things as everybody else, but that you also have to treat people the same way that everyone else has to treat people. So I had the same rights, but I also had the same responsibilities.
Jack,
when I was growing up, I didn't have anybody around me who was also in a wheelchair. So, I mean, I went to a mainstream school, so all my friends were walking, but I had no one else who was an adult in my life that was in a wheelchair or had a disability of any sort around me. So growing up, I was brought up around just, you know, being with all my mates from school and my parents' friends, and so none of them really sort of understood where we were coming from with being in a chair. They just sort of treated me like I was able-bodied, which is great. I wouldn't change that. But what I want to do with the whole inspirational path is be an inspiration for kids who are, say, at the moment they're like 6 or 7 years old, and by the time they're my age now and they're 18, they can look up to somebody in a wheelchair, and there will be someone for them who will, you know, teach them life tips if they need them, or tell them, I mean, it sounds patronising, but telling them that they're not limited, you know what I mean? Like, to say that they don't know they're not limited, is that patronising? Well, of course not, because we do look at obstacles and think, yeah, we are limited. If you put a flight of stairs in front of me, I look limited. However, if I get out of my wheelchair and climb up those stairs and crawl up those stairs and get to the top, at the end of the day, I wasn't limited because I still achieved what I wanted to, which was to get to the top of that stairs.
But they could have just put in a lift. social model stuff. But actually,
is that how you got your Children of Courage Award? By crawling upstairs?
Yeah, I had my chair on my back and I was a turtle which got up.
What do they make you kids do in the UK?
I definitely do not want to get on the wrong side of you because you know how to put it out there.
Sorry, I just, you know.
Stella is coming to London. She'll be at the Soho Theatre in July 2015.
Get your tickets now.
More
I
details.
Am going.
Yes, so we are definitely going. Now, so thank you very much, Stella. I really appreciate your time. Stu, stay there. We'll be returning to you in a little while. You're listening to Ouch Disability Talk from the BBC. And before we turn to Jack Binstead, let's hear him in action on BBC Three comedy show Bad Education. In this clip, he's talking about that famous disabled physicist fella, Stephen someone.
Okay, so that Stuart Hawking bloke, he's the brainiest guy in the world, right?
Stephen Hawking, yeah, but...
Right, so if he's so deadly, who'd win in a fight between him and a tiger?
Well, the tiger, obviously.
So he's not the deadliest?
That's not the point.
What about him versus a shark?
The shark?
What, even on dry land?
No, I guess on dry land the shark would probably dry out. I can't believe I'm even playing this game. Look, there are plenty of animals that could kill Stephen Hawking.
Like a badger?
Yes, a badger probably would.
How, though?
I don't know. Bite him. Give him TB.
Tell us about Rem Dog, your character.
Rem Dog.
Yeah, well, Rem Dog is... he's changed in the third series from what he was in the first and second series. The first and second series was very attitude-like. He was very... He used his disability to get himself sort of out of sticky situations, and you know, he'd be late for class and his excuse would be the fact that the wheelchair doesn't push itself, and that was the first line that Rem Dog ever said in the first series was literally, he went wheelchair when he asked why he was late, and his mate pops up behind him and goes, yeah, this thing that pushed himself, you know, and then we got out of all the trouble because of being late for school in the first day of term because of that. And so that's very much what he's like, you know, he's very argumentative, he's very stuck in his ways, and he just sort of It's so annoying. I'm so far from him, but at the same time, I'm
so him.
I was
going to say, is that life imitating art? Or
so there is actually quite a few aspects of Remdog which are true in Jack. But then there are other side of things where I'd probably try... when I'm back in school, I probably tried to be like Remdog, which didn't work. So
yeah, what was school like for you then?
It wasn't too bad. I mean, when I went to the primary school, it was, I went to a mainstream primary school and secondary school, and so I wasn't treated any differently. And in fact, when it came down to sports especially, I excelled in nearly every single sport than anybody who could walk in my school could do so. You know, if I were playing basketball, I'd always be able to shoot further than them could. Or if we were playing football, I would always be the goalkeeper. I would never say no because they're playing a game which is predominantly made for people who are able-bodied. I would still join in and adapt it. And moving on to secondary school, a lot of my friends from primary school came with me, and so they knew of my condition. So they knew that, you know, I could break easier. But then again, no one treated me differently, so it really wasn't too bad an experience. I really did enjoy it going through school.
Now, you had quite an unusual start to your TV career, didn't you, after a mishap grabbed the attention of the producers at the Paul O'Grady show. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I was 12 years old at the time, and I'd been training, you know, 5-6 days a week throughout the winter previous to 2000 previous to when I was 12, and I trained so hard, and I really wanted to take the title for the under 15 London Junior Marathon winner. I really wanted to take the title for the first time ever. And 5 days before the London Junior Marathon on the Tuesday, due to racing the Sunday, I snapped my tibia and fibula in my right leg and proper. Ouch. I bent it round in a good 50-degree bend.
Wow.
Simply through kicking a football. And so I rushed straight into hospital. They had to, like, pull my leg, get it back into the, like, straight position. And they said to me, you know, you're out. You know, there's no racing for you. You're going to be out for the next couple of months at the very least. And, you know, I'm really sorry that this has happened to you, basically. There's not much more they could say about it. And so I was sort of down and depressed for a couple of days about it and picked myself back up. And on the Friday, I told them I was still racing. So I made them cut my plaster cast off and put a bandage around this break. And on Sunday, I turned up at the race, got in my chair on the start line, and just put my head down, really, and just went for it. And I think the adrenaline took over from the pain, really.
But should people with brittle bones do this kind of thing? I mean, you're also, don't you do BMX wheelchair stuff as
well? Yeah, WCMX. It's a sport that was invented a few years back by a guy called Aaron Fotheringham from America, and he's part of Nitro Circus, and he came up with the idea that people in wheelchairs can do BMX tricks. You know, we're basically a bike just sitting down. That's what we are. Minus a chain and minus a handlebars, we are a bike. And we can do all their tricks. And he started doing wheelchair backflips and wheelchair front flips. And since then, he's done a double backflip in a wheelchair. And so I kind of took that on board and said, you know, if he can do that, I can do that. And obviously, I'm sitting there with brittle bone disease.
I'm going to say,
should I be doing that?
Not wanting to sound like your mum, but I mean, that sounds very dangerous to me. That sounds like
path. Have you tried doing jigsaws?
Yeah.
You see, that right there, what you guys said about the Lego and the jigsaw, is why I do it. Because with the condition, I have broken and can do at any point in the future, just roll over in bed and break my legs. I did that when I was a kid. I rolled over and snapped my femur bone. Okay. Now, I'm not going to not get out of bed in the morning purely because I'm scared that I'm going to hurt myself in the process. I will always get out of bed because otherwise I'm not living my day. What's the point? So I'll get out of bed. I will do my day. Part of my day now with all the filming involves me doing lots of stupid stunts and capturing them on camera. Now, I would much rather go into A&E and explain that I broke my leg doing a backflip in my wheelchair than just saying I rolled over in bed because I couldn't be bothered to get out of bed that morning.
I mean, Tim, do you
understand? Hang on a minute. You're telling me that the reason you lead your life the way you do is because you want to impress nurses.
Very much so. I lead the life that I do because I'm supposed to not do so.
What did you, is this a sentiment you agree with, Tim?
I get completely what Jack said.
Yeah.
There's every single facet of my day is, in theory, not achievable. playing league hockey that I do is not achievable with my lung condition at 43, but I still do it because then you feel that you're actually alive, you know, and that whole scenario that you'd rather break bones going for life rather than doing something facile. Yeah. I get that completely.
You're just making me and Kate feel.
I just was sitting here thinking, yes. I don't do enough now.
Kate with her
onesie.
Oh,
they've just high fived as well.
Disabled United here. This is. Oh.
Kate, should we just go for some wine?
Yeah.
I think we need to get out of it.
In my onesie.
In your onesie.
In my onesie.
Is it drink driving if you drive in your wheelchair?
Yes, I think it is. Now, Jack, you started your own YouTube channel and you were actually filming us earlier, weren't you, with your little camera?
I have been, yes.
Now, here's a clip from a recent video where you're actually talking about being born with the condition osteogenesis imperfecta. For those of us who aren't doctors, that means brittle bone disease. Let's have a listen.
I was born with this condition, and I was born without any broken bones, but as I was born, I broke my skull. The forceps broke my skull. And I continued to break bones every 2 weeks after, you know, being born. An arm or a leg, and it carried on, and so they obviously knew that something was wrong with me, but before they diagnosed me with my condition, unfortunately, my parents were actually accused of child abuse, which was absolutely horrible. My parents are the greatest parents ever. They've been so supportive of me over the years, and, you know, wherever I go into, wherever I go, I know I'll have their support. Give this video a thumbs up, comment and subscribe if you liked it. I've got loads more videos. Go away! God.
And we're glad you've been let out on parole after that.
So
interesting incident.
You're part of this whole YouTube thing, which I had to spend quite a while explaining to my producer, who had no idea that vlogging was a thing, that basically, you know,
amazing.
The YouTube was a thing.
Yeah.
So is this another way of trying to get famous, like Zoella and Alfie?
This isn't
and
another
people.
Way of getting famous. This is another way of me getting my points across. This is another way of me getting my voice heard. It's not about fame. I'm not bothered about being famous. What I'm bothered about is making sure that the audience that I want my voice to be heard by is heard. And you know, the type of people that if we are inspirations, the type of people that would class us as inspirations are either adults who don't understand what we actually go through and they assume that they do, or they're teenagers, okay? And obviously through bad education, a lot of the fans I have are sort of between 13 and 16. That's generally the age group of fans that we have, and they're the fans that watch YouTube. That's the age group that watch YouTube, and it's such an amazing tool in order to get your voice heard and get yourself out there. And if fame comes with that, I would never turn it down, okay? I would not sit here and admit that I don't want to be famous one day, okay? Because then I would be lying to you guys.
Yeah.
Of course I do.
Everyone does.
Everyone does. You know, I would love the limelight on me 24/7. I aim to achieve that. But more importantly, I just want to get my voice heard first.
So what is the future for you then, Jack? What can we see you doing next?
Well, obviously I'm going to continue doing TV work. I've got a few programmes lined up.
Secret projects?
Yeah, I know I'm not going to reveal too much, but I will be releasing lots of updates through the YouTube and through social network sites, Twitter and Instagram. I'm always taking a cute selfie here and there. So I'll be able to reveal where I'm going and what I'm doing there. But with the YouTube, I plan to carry that on, and I really, really enjoyed it. It's only been the last sort of 2 weeks I've actually launched my new channel, and the responses I've had so far have been absolutely amazing, so...
So stay where you are. Obviously, the link to all of Jack's stuff is all on the Ouch website as well, with bbc.co.uk/ouch. And do stick with us, Jack, and we're going to do a quiz with you and Stella a little bit later. Now, still to come. This is a Disneyland. I'm not a novelty. This is a That's the Sisters of Invention. They're a five-piece girl band from Australia, all of whom have learning disabilities. We'll be playing the whole of that track to end the show. Now, Tim Watton is 43 years old, not a remarkable age for most people, but Tim has cystic fibrosis, a condition which means that 50% of people who have it don't survive beyond 30. He's written a book called How Have I Cheated Death, which is subtitled A Short and Merry Life with Cystic Fibrosis. He's married to Katie, has a son, Felix, and is a business consultant. And in his spare time, he plays hockey for a local team called Edwardians. So, Tim, let's establish in a nutshell for those who don't know it, what CF is.
So cystic fibrosis is a genetic illness. So my mum and dad were carriers without realising. Then there's a 1 in 4 chance that any children will have that condition. It's worth pointing out that there's about 1,000 variations or mutations of the illness. So you could be mild, really unaffected, maybe even go your whole life undiagnosed, through to very severe. I'm in the sort of severe echelon. My mutation is Delta 508, so I am a number, not a name.
Sounds like a spaceship.
Quite a good film, doesn't it?
Levi 508. And, it is severe. I lost many dear friends to the illness. There's a lot of medication needed every day just to have a semblance of health. It affects a lot of the main organs, the lungs, our digestive system, the pancreas. Hence why I've recently got my diabetes, which is a joke. It's like my reward for staying alive.
I mean, you say you've lost many dear friends to CF, but I always wonder, when you have CF, you're not allowed to be in the same room as someone else who has CF. So how do you form those friendships and relationships when you can't be in the same room together?
A lot of the what you've just alluded to has only come through in the last 5-10 years about cross-infection. I actually used to go down the pub in Brompton with a fellow CF patient back in the 80s and 90s. So you actually form relationships through normal meeting in the waiting room. Now that you can't physically be in the same room because of cross-infection, social media is a big way. Another reason I wrote the book, to hear my voice and give hope to those with the illness that there could be a future, that CF doesn't have to be just about existing, that you can actually have a life that makes a difference, you can have a family, but you do need to respect the illness. You do need to knuckle down every day. And the sort of mental approach I have is, I'm a bit of a Depeche Mode fan, it's shake the disease. You know, you've got it, it's not going to go away, there's no cure. Just understand what it needs every day, then, you know, like Dirty Dancing, put it in the corner. You know, it's tucked away. Once, you know, you've nailed it every day, then if there's 3 hours of treatment every day for me, then that's 21 hours for Tim Watton, 3 hours for CF, and I feel then I'm putting it in its place.
And impressive cultural references there, zinging from Depeche Mode to Dirty Dancing within the space of 2 sentences.
Yeah, I'm an 80s
child. I do wonder what's on your iPod, yeah. So the book's called How Have I Cheated Death, which is obviously quite a self-explanatory title, but what prompted you to write the book?
So getting to 30 is... it was unexpected. All of my 20s, I lived for, you know, people talk about living for the moment. I lived for this nanosecond. If there was a party, I'd go to 5 in a night, you know, just squeeze every drop out of life. Mm. But miraculously, I got to 30, met my wife, Katie, and I just thought, potentially, there's a different outcome for me. And then as I got close to 40, and I was still playing my hockey, then had a son, Felix, working hard, I thought, actually, this is too big to not share. I started a blog called Counting Down to 40, and then that was so popular that actually my written style was appreciated. It's not didactic, it doesn't preach, it's very honest, it's raw, it's funny. It's just my way of speaking, obviously, on the page. But because hitting 40 was such an achievement, I felt actually I needed to do more with my writing, and then I wrote the book. Actually, I wrote a lot of the book on the Northern Line, going up to a Northern Line London tube, going up to Canary Wharf on for work. So you actually can make use of your tube journey, guys out there.
You don't need to play Candy Crush all the time, do you?
I'm very interested in the fact that you decided to start a family. And I know that it can be quite a hot topic with CFers about whether or not someone with CF, you know that your life is limited, should you have children? And then you also have the added problem that many males with CF are often infertile as well as a result of having CF. What was it like making that decision to have a child, knowing that you might not be there to see them grow up?
So, as Jack alluded to, anything you do in your life that almost smacks your condition in the face and says, I'm not going to take it, I'll be winning this one. And it's actually resetting yourself every day with that mindset. So getting to 30 was a knock in CF's face saying, no, I'm still here. And then getting married was a natural progression when I met Katie. She was a hockey player as well. So, you know, if you play hockey, many things can happen, magic things can happen to you. Starting a family was another progression, just thinking, this feels normal. You know, if I can do what my peers are doing, CF is, again, it's not sidelined, but it's not defining me. And it could easily define me every day. I could introduce myself, Tim Watton, I've got CF. I don't. I say I could do X, Y, and Z, and by the way, I've got the illness. So having a family, yes, I may not be around, but he's seven now. He's my healthy clone. I'm maintaining my health, and I want to keep playing hockey, and I want to be there to see him go to uni. I want to teach him how to play hockey myself. So, you know, I've got even more motivation now that he's in my life. So it's actually the reverse psychology.
You talk a lot about coughing in your book. I mean, it can be quite dramatic, I think, for sometimes. I mean, how do people react to that? Do they think you're going to sort of die on them mid-conversation?
So I actually find the Farce Show sketch about Bob Fleming funny when he's trying to catch his breath and coughing. Mm. There are times where I have to leave business meetings because it's caught me. When I'm playing hockey, I'm having a bad coughing fit. People ask me if I've been down the pub the night before. So there is some humour in there. But no, there are some very, very tough times where CF definitely beats me up every day. Think of it as a boxing match. You knock down, you just got to get back up. So coughing, it's funny and ironic that coughing and coffin sound are similar.
you take about 40 tablets a day?
40 tablets, yeah, all different colours to keep it interesting.
I thought my 12 a day were good, but no.
Then there's nebulizers, there's inhalers, there's my injections because of the diabetes. And actually, having that, I've not had a day off, not one day off from that level of medication every day. And that's a good day. When I have an intravenous treatment, then it could go up to 6-7 hours of meds, an IV line, and more coughing. And it does tiring. If you cough when you've had a cold, guys, it gets so tiring, doesn't it?
It's boring, just, yeah.
It's boring and tiring. And we sort of know that. I mean, only this week I was up for an hour having a severe coughing fit, hoping that I wouldn't wake my wife and son. So there's that sort of scenario. As you get older, suddenly it's not just about you. You've got to think of others.
Tell me a little bit about your Windows 7 approach to every hour of the day, this sort of very exhaustively carpe diem.
Yeah, I love Windows 7. So Windows 7 is, if there's seven windows in every weekend, Friday evening, Saturday morning, afternoon, lunch, and an evening, and the same for Sunday. For me, that was seven opportunities to tear the arse out of life, have fun, and I didn't ever want to miss any window at all.
Can we say tear the arse out of life?
Well, sorry.
Not sure about that.
I think we just did.
Yeah.
Sorry, I've just done it. It was for me, if you don't think you're going to hit 30, and most people you know with the illness have already died, you're not thinking, oh, I'll just put my feet up at the weekend. You're going to just have so much fun. You're going to go to every party. You're going to play hockey. And if I could out party, out play sport, everybody I knew who was healthy, I felt I was sort of winning the battle.
I just feel inadequate because I think most of my Windows 7 is taken up with napping and watching box sets.
Your medicine cabinet must be huge.
Well, you know that the leisurely alcoholics have alcohol stored in around different parts of the house? Well, it's the same with my CF. There's compartments and cupboards that are stored everywhere. But it is, It is a very big cupboard.
It's a medicine cabinet with a conveniently situated house within it.
Well, it's basically a conservatory.
My son is very used to it now. You know, he's seen me from day one do my nebulizer, which looks odd. He's seen me pop pills. He said, oh, daddy's having his sweets again. You know, so it's become a very normalised existence.
So Tim's book, How Have I Cheated Death, is out now. And now it's time for Ouch News, where we get one of our citizen correspondents on the line with news from their part of the disability community. Today, it's our Cures correspondent, Jocelyn Tompkinson. She's in Vancouver, and I spoke to her recently. Jocelyn works in spinal research and so was very interested in a widely reported piece of news at the end of October about a paralysed man, Derek Fadika, who was able to walk again. Described as a breakthrough, it was all thanks to a pioneering therapy which involved transplanting cells from his nasal cavity into his spinal cord. Nose to spine, so bizarre. So I asked Jocelyn what kind of reaction she gets when significant-sounding stories like this come to light.
Two or three such stories have come to light while I've been working at my current job. And each time it happens, we get calls from people who live in our part of Canada and beyond calling us and saying, can I be a part, can I get that treatment? Regardless of how far developed the supposed breakthrough or treatment is. For example, the one that happened that came out of, I think, Switzerland by Dr. Cortin several years ago, the supposed breakthrough was in mice. And people were calling us asking when they could get the treatment.
Wow.
So, yeah, so it's a little bit confusing, I think, for a lot of people. And it results in a big misunderstanding.
I mean, is this a big breakthrough?
I think that it's really promising. It's interesting. But the problem is it's in one person. And I think for the general public, they say, yes, it's in one person. This fellow who had paraplegia, he had paralysis in half of his body, is able to stand up and walk a few steps with a walker, and that's a lot more than he had before. But the problem is that we don't know a whole lot about spinal cord injury yet, and what we don't know is why some injuries in one person might result in no paralysis. In another person, the same type of injury might result in complete paralysis. It's really impossible to say whether it was just he benefited a lot from the exercise that went along with it. Mm. It's just too hard to know.
So, Justin, when people are reading these kinds of headlines and then they come to you and say, can I have the cure? You know, what can you do to help me now? We've read about this. We want this to happen. I've heard you might be able to make me walk again. How does it feel to have to turn around to them and say, well, no, we can't?
It's really tough. And we at our center had a lot of long conversations about how we should respond. I should be really clear, you know, we're first in the line to cheer on good research. We really want to see regeneration in nerve cells. We want to see people get back on their feet and walk. But I think that what we want is for people with spinal cord injury to understand, you know, the progress that's happening now that they can take advantage of, and to be really aware of what great treatments and exercises they can be involved in now, as well as in the future.
How do they react to those kinds of answers?
I think it's probably largely unsatisfying for them. Unfortunately, often we get these questions by email or on our Facebook page, and they respond. They usually don't respond, and if they do, it's sort of like, but it was on the news. I want that treatment. Why can't I have it? And this is one of the hidden problems, is that we get these questions and then we say, well, we can't bring it to you. It's not safe yet. We don't know how we could apply this treatment yet. It's not really a treatment. It's more of just a research progress. People think that we're holding something back from the public, that we think that we're somehow hoarding the cure for ourselves in science or academia. But really, science takes a very long time, and that's important that we test it and make sure it's safe and make sure it applies to, you know, which patients, so we don't hurt anyone in the process.
That was our Cures correspondent, Jocelyn Tomkinson, and we urge you to go and listen to her podcast, Gimp Hacks, which she describes as being an irreverent show about disability. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? The latest edition is called Pulling the Gimp Card. And so now it's time to play our almost legendary quiz, where we get to find out how many disability stories you've absorbed over the last month. I welcome back Jack. Hello, Jack.
Hello.
I welcome back Tim. Hello, Tim.
Hiya.
And from Melbourne, I welcome back Stella. Hello, Stella.
Hello.
Okay, let's get straight on with this then. I just want you to shout out the answer if you possibly know it. Now, Police Scotland have overturned a ban on officers with a particular impairment over the last month. What is it? Any guesses?
Oh my God.
This is silence. Silence in the studio. Lots of blank looks.
Lots of, yeah, I don't know.
Have a guess.
Impairment.
Come on, Stella.
Is it with
blind people?
Not far away. It was actually colour blindness, reported by the Herald Scotland. The recruit who had passed all of the other tests to begin training to become a police officer was told his moderate colour blindness meant he would be unable to pursue a career in the force. But now he can.
What? Hello.
Yeah. Wait, so presumably that means that people who are just blind and not just colour blind can be police officers.
We shall return to this
in
a future show.
Yes.
But considering most burglars just wear black and white jumpsuits and bags of swag written on the back.
I'm ironically, sure whether... Stella, you really know how to put your foot in it, don't you?
And the next question.
Reported last month from the Telegraph. Oh, do you want to read this one?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, fine, go on then.
Pipe
go
down.
On. Go on.
Anyway, question number two. Reported last month in the Telegraph, what classic disability faux pas did a harvester waitress make as she started to serve James Lusted, a person of restricted growth, who was out having a meal with his fiancée, who is of average height?
Oh, I actually read this. Oh, yes. I actually read this.
Oh, did they give him a children's meal?
Boom!
Oh,
Stella!
Yes. Almost, almost. She gave him crayons and a colouring book to play with.
Oh, can you imagine?
While he was on a date with his girlfriend.
Oh, nice. I actually was on a date once and somebody, like, my meal came all, like, cut up into little pieces, which was a really, like, pre-cut up, which was slightly mortifying and made for some very interesting discussion on the date. It's the ultimate test, really.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I think, frankly, if you're going on a date in a harvester, you've only got yourself to blame, quite frankly. That is not a good date, venue.
Oh, man, I'm going to have to cancel this date tomorrow night. I'm joking.
Has anyone ever done anything like that to you, Jack? Because you are quite short. I mean, let's put it bluntly.
Yeah. Well, you just did.
Jesus, put it out there. I'm short in stature. Like, I'm 4'10".
It's pretty short.
Yes, that's pretty damn
short. Shorter than me.
I win. I'm 2'11".
Oh, whatever, Stella.
She always beats you, Jack. She always does.
Yeah, if we were racing, though, you know we'd win. or drinking. We'll get there another day.
I don't know. Are you challenging an Australian woman in drinking? I don't
know. Yeah, I didn't think that went through, did I?
Don't bite off more than you can chew, mate. Seriously.
Tim, have you ever been patronised?
Apart
from on this show. Only by actually a hockey umpire who said you shouldn't be playing hockey with a cough like that. He wasn't to know, but it did hit hard.
Interesting. Right, I'm going to go, everyone. Sorry. I have a hospital appointment that starts in 7 minutes and is 10 minutes away. And as the BBC is an excellent, equality rights employer, I'm allowed to leave our podcast in order to go and make my appointment.
That you're putting your general health and well-being before finishing a quiz.
Afraid so. Enjoy the rest of the quiz. Thank you very much, and I'll see you next time.
What a showboater. Right, anyway.
And I'm going to say bye to Kate's vlog. He's vlogging this, so everyone
I'm
watch it on YouTube.
Thing.
Bye,
Kate,
guys.
Kate,
bye.
You're dead to me.
Later, guys.
Get off. Get out. Right, the final question then. God, this is just... Oh. Like local radio. Now, the final question in the quiz. What was, Tim, Jack and Stella, my new friends, what was the Feel the Force Day? Any guesses?
Feel the Force?
That sounds like something to do with being blind. Like, you gotta feel it. Like, maybe you can't see it, so you feel the Force.
Would there be perhaps a very famous George Lucas-directed movie that would give you some clue as to what this might be?
Definitely not.
Star Wars?
Ah, Stella, yes, indeed. It was a special accessible Star Wars Day in Peterborough for disabled people who were invited to, and I quote, stroke a Wookiee, sniff the scent of the Millennium Falcon, and hug Princess first layer.
Can you imagine how many Daleks, or not Daleks, that's Doctor Who, isn't it? How many R2-D2s turned up that day?
Oh, my God.
Numerous. Now, yeah, this was a convention about textures, smells and contact, bringing Star Wars to life for disabled people, reported by the BBC's Look East news programme. So who won that quiz? I'm going to probably give it to Stella, mainly because I'm scared of her, but because I think you also got the majority of the questions right.
So, Stella, I love that I'm on the other side of the world and I'm the most scary one.
You are capable of causing fear and trepidation. So you win nothing other than our best wishes, but congratulations anyway. I know it's changed your life. Yeah.
Thank you. I don't win any races and never have, so this is quite an honour.
And you can have Jack's Children of Courage nomination letter whenever you want. So yeah, we're all out of time. Thank you to our guests, Stella Young, Tim Watton and Jack Binstead. We'll be back in mid-December with our Christmas edition, and further thanks must go to Emma Tracy, Kathleen Hawkins, our studio manager Jill Drabble, and the man without whom we would be nothing, producer and creator of Ouch, Damon Rose. So music this month comes from the Sisters of Invention. They're an Aussie girl group with a difference. They write their own songs, they choose their own clothes, and all five members have learning disabilities. Their debut album comes out in early 2015, and there's a single from it out now. Now, this track was written in anger, apparently, responding to a support worker who thought that the Sisters of Invention should only perform in front of children. There's a really good video of it, which we've linked to from our site, so do go and click it when you've got a moment. Here's the track. It's called This Isn't Disneyland, from me and that Skiver Monaghan. Goodbye.
You learn something new every day, new every day, till the day that you die. I left school years ago, thought you should know. And although there's obstacles, struggles and falls, there's a brick wall. I'm not saying you're mean, but there are some things.